was instead being tightened. Yandy knew of Japanese atrocities in China and had no wish to exchange one form of slavery for another, possibly much worse, he wrote. He believed, however, that if the Japanese were being drawn to India, that was because it was an Allied base. Removing the British would eliminate this bait. The Indian National Congress was also receiving alarming accounts of the Scorched Earth program in Bengal. In July, it exhorted the people to defy the requisitioning of boats and vehicles unless they received adequate compensation. Amory saw the proclamation as a petty ploy to obstruct the war effort and wrote to Churchill urging prompt action. Twice armed is he that has his quarrel just, but thrice armed he who gets his blow in first. The Viceroy notified British Army and Air Force units to stand by for a crackdown. Not wanting to strike before he had a provocation, he waited until spies could confirm that the Congress was planning a program of civil disobedience. Meanwhile, Chiang Kai-shek heard from Gandhi and informed Roosevelt that an uprising could still be averted if he would persuade the United Kingdom to restore to India her complete freedom. Roosevelt forwarded the letter to Churchill, asking only how the president should respond. The Prime Minister replied angrily that the President should lend no countenance to putting pressure upon His Majesty's government. From then on, a resigned Roosevelt ignored pleas to intervene that came from several quarters, including a cable from American writer Louis Fisher, who had interviewed Gandhi and who now warned that a terrible disaster may be impending in India. On August 8, 1942, the Indian National Congress, with much hesitation and doubt, adopted what came to be called the Quit India Resolution. It was, in part, a last-ditch appeal to the United States. British rule, the document stated, was degrading and enfeebling India and making her progressively less capable of defending herself. If granted independence, Indians would eagerly throw in their lot with the Allies. But if this plea were denied, the Congress would sanction a non-violent struggle on the widest possible scale. The party asked the people to hold together under Gandhi's guidance as disciplined soldiers of Indian freedom. Should a time come when the leaders could no longer lead, everyone who desired liberation must be his own guide, urging him on along the hard road where there is no resting place and which leads ultimately to the independence of India. Early the next morning, all the senior Congress leaders were swept off to jail. Gandhi managed to call out the words, "Karengi ya marengi," meaning do or die, as a final message to his countrymen before he was imprisoned. That evening, Amory spoke over BBC Radio. In addition to the usual strikes and demonstrations, he said, the Congress had envisaged cutting telegraph and telephone lines, picketing army recruitment centres and government offices, and otherwise paralysing the government. Such actions amounted to sabotaging the war effort. The broadcast successfully turned American and British public opinion against Gandhi and the Congress. Amory's statement was in accordance with a War Cabinet resolve from as early as September 14, 1940, that if conflict with Congress should arise, it should appear as an outcome of war necessity rather than as a political quarrel unrelated to the war. Although the radical action of paralysing the government had indeed been suggested at a regional Congress meeting, the National Party had not endorsed it. But Amory's broadcast had an unintended effect. The sudden arrest of Congress leaders had left them with no opportunity to decide, let alone explain to their subordinates, exactly what form civil obedience should take. Amory did it for them. Every Indian who heard the tactics he detailed took them as instructions direct from the Congress, and the very next day the country exploded in a seemingly coordinated rebellion. Enraged crowds attacked government offices, destroyed telegraph poles and damaged railway tracks. In Bihar, two Canadian airmen were lynched, leading to a retaliatory attack in which aircraft strafed crowds of protesters, killing several hundred. Clive Branson followed all of this unrest closely. Discussions go on night and day, with views expressed ranging from two extremes. A. I came to fight the Japs, not the Indians. To B. It would be all right to have a go at Gandhi and his Hindus. We should get some practice like the Japs got in China. Branson related to his wife. Being a communist, he dismissed Gandhi as bourgeois and saw no virtue in pacifism. But when it came to the Quit India movement, he felt that the problem was not so much Gandhi as his absence. The Labour Party had asked the Congress to call off civil disobedience. How brilliant! Doesn't the Labour Party know that the Congress leaders are in jail, and that is why the rioting is going on? Anarchistic, because without leadership, he railed. On August 20, 1942, when soldiers from his squadron were dispatched to maintain law and order in a nearby town, Branson stole off to a canteen to be by himself. This sort of warfare is so distasteful to me that I take every care not to be detailed, he explained to his wife. Perusal of the newspapers soon convinced him that British imperialists had deliberately provoked the rebellion, which offered the long-sought opportunity to smash the nationalist movement. To prohibit the Indians from fighting the war as free allies was to damage the war effort, he opined, for now the natives cared not at all about the aggressor at the doorstep, but only wanted to be rid of the one in the room. We English fellows came out here to fight the Japs and face the possibility of finding a grave, Branson continued. We did not come here to be killed by Indians provoked by the insane reactionary policy of Amory and Co. Figuring that the Viceroy would need as much British strength as possible in these difficult times, Churchill stopped a division from being moved out of India as per an earlier schedule. There was no chance of the Japanese arriving during the monsoon, which allowed 6 weeks for 222,000 policemen and 57 battalions of soldiers to contain an uprising by essentially unarmed civilians. By May 1943, as many as 105 battalions would be involved, all of which were fed, clothed, sheltered, remunerated, and largely equipped at the expense of Indians. Meeting Churchill at a train station, Amory found the Prime Minister looking very fit and in capital spirits, as he wrote in his diary. His only remark to me was, "We've got them on the run." Soon after, however, an Indian member of the Viceroy's Council met Churchill and found him rumbling with rage. "What have we to be ashamed of in our government of India? Why should we be apologetic or say that we are prepared to go out at the instance of some jackanapes?" the Prime Minister fumed. "If we have ever to quit India, we shall quit it in a blaze of glory, and the chapter that shall be ended then will be the most glorious chapter of that country, not merely in relation to the past, but equally in relation to the future, however distant that may be. That will be my statement on India tomorrow. No apology, no quitting, no idea of weakening or scuttling." That very day, while discussing his forthcoming speech with Amory, Churchill exclaimed, "I hate Indians. They are a beastly people with a beastly religion." The Prime Minister's euphoria had rapidly soured into resentment because of the vital concession he had been forced to make. India would get dominion status after the war. With the American president prodding him, the offer would be hard to rescind. And once India became a dominion, it would likely opt for full independence. The ferocity of the repression had ensured that much. The tighter he grasped, the more surely the prize slipped away. In his broadcast on September 10, 1942, the Prime Minister announced that the Congress had finally thrown off its cloak of non-violence. The conspirators, he asserted, had received help from Japanese Fifth Column work on a widely extended scale and with special direction to strategic points. But there was no cause to worry, in part because the numbers of white soldiers now in that country, though very small compared with its size and population, are larger than at any time in the British connection. The speech infuriated Branson, who wrote home that it was just filth, without even the virtue of invented evidence to support the case. Despite Churchill's insistence, the Secret Service had failed to turn up any links between fascists and Gandhi or other Congress leaders. There were none. Summing up the Quit India movement in The Hinge of Fate, Churchill wrote, "What was at one time feared to become the most serious rebellion in India since the Sepoy Mutiny of 1857 fizzled out in a few months with hardly any loss of life. In Midnapore district of Bengal, however, the uprising would lead to a lethal confrontation with authorities. It would also give birth to a secret government that would endure for 2 tortuous years through famine of an intensity not seen since the Victorian era." Chapter 4. At Any Price. The news of Gandhi's arrest left the nationalists of Midnapore stunned. That August of 1942, after much discussion in their rural hideouts, the top leaders of the district's Congress, brawny, mustachioed Satish Chandra Samanta, and his close friend, the small and sharp-witted Ajoy Kumar Mukhopadhyay, decided on a course of action. On September 29, 1942, the people of Tamluk subdivision, where the Congress organization was strongest, would take over all government offices in the locale. Unarmed crowds would have to face down armed police and perhaps even soldiers. Sushil Dara, the insurgency's designated warrior, had built up a cadre of youths who seemed ready to risk their lives at his behest. But Dara had been trying hard to live by Gandhian precepts, and he demanded to know how the planned program squared with the policy of non-violence. So the elders sent him on a risky trip to Calcutta to meet a respected Gandhian educator. If enormous crowds approached government buildings, the guru postulated, the occupants might surrender without a fight. He also showed Dara a publication in Hindi. In Gandhi's absence, those of his disciples who had evaded capture were freely interpreting his enigmatic instructions, "Do or die," and their readings of their leader's injunctions leaned increasingly toward allowing violence as a means of moving toward independence. Dara returned to Midnapore with a cloudless mind and threw himself into planning the day of liberation. "I searched within my mind and found in it no fear," he would write. From among his recruits, he selected 50 whom he judged were also ready to face death. On September 8, Dara heard that police shootings had claimed 3 lives at a riverside rice mill at Donipur near Tamluk. Arriving at the site, he found a few thousand agitated people surrounding the building. The small police force was inside, as were the bodies of the slain men. The day before, villagers had resolved to stop a barge loaded with 30 tons of rice from being dispatched upstream to the Isbahani Company, and women had used their conch shells to summon hundreds of people to the riverbank. The mill owners had sent for help, and an officer with 5 armed policemen had arrived the next morning. The villagers had asked to buy 2 kilograms of rice each, but the mill owners had refused. When the angry crowd entered the mill, the police had fired in panic. Dara advised the villagers to distribute the rice among the needy, but to let the officer and the other policemen go. Leaving a few subordinates at the site, he walked back to his hideout. Dara's route lay through the town of Mohisadal and past the home of the very police officer whose life he had just saved. It was 11 p.m. when he was striding by, and he spied a forlorn woman, clearly the officer's wife, staring out of the window. She called to him, asking if he had seen any trouble on the road. "A wicked idea came into my head," Dara related later. Pretending to be just a passerby, he told her of having seen a large crowd holding a police officer hostage and threatening to burn him alive. A Congress leader named Sushil Dara, he said, had been firing up the crowd by saying all kinds of angry things. Leaving the poor woman close to tears, he went on his way. Whatever the morals of this prank, it was the last time Dara would do anything playful. As for the villagers, 13 of them would serve up to 2 years of hard labour each on charges of looting. On the night of September 28, thousands of men, armed with spades, shovels, saws and axes, slipped out of their huts to gather in darkness on the arterial roads of southern Midnapore. According to a history of the insurgency written by one of its participants, Radhakrishna Bari, they dug gaping holes in the road surfaces, broke through culverts and sawed laboriously through ancient roadside trees, dropping them, branches and leaves and all, onto the path. One guy told me he was bitten by a snake, but he threw it off and just kept on felling, recalled Kumudini Dakwa. Fortunately, it wasn't poisonous. There were no electricity poles to worry about, but the men snapped telegraph and telephone poles and slashed all wires within reach. Through a network of informers, word reached the local police that the people were about to take back the government. Discovering that all communication lines were down, they used the wireless set at a military observation post outside Tamluk to warn the district magistrate in Midnapore town to the northwest. 2 truckloads of troops set off toward Tamluk, only to find the road impassable. Soldiers descended from the trucks, got people out of nearby hamlets, and set them to work at gunpoint, repairing breaches and removing trees. Dawn found 3 processions, from the north, northwest, and south, making their way toward Tamluk town. The Rup Narayan River flowed along the eastern side of Tamluk, blocking approach from that direction. The people sang, shouted slogans, and waved green, white, and orange Congress flags. No one had weapons. We'd hoped that the soldiers wouldn't make it. If so, we had word that the police would surrender, Bari would later recall. The son of a poor farmer, he had just left his Calcutta college to join the Midnapore insurgency and would become its chronicler. But when the crowd from the northwest detoured into a soccer field to listen to instructions, the military trucks pushed past it to reach Tamluk at 2:30 p.m. The demonstrators, arriving at the town's police station half an hour later, found themselves facing rows of constables with lathis, bamboo rods lethal in trained hands, and behind them soldiers with guns. The police charged into the crowd, but because it continued to edge forward, the soldiers fired, killing 3. At about the same time, the southern procession reached a 20-foot bridge spanning a canal, and sepoys stationed on the north side fired without warning. Many of the wounded started crying out for water. Most of them were Hindu, and they believed a sip of holy water before death ensured salvation. From a lane to the right came a prostitute, Sabitri Dasi, with a goti, or small brass vessel, from which she began pouring water into the mouths of the injured and dying. Sepoys raced forward and shouted at her to stop. Dasi withdrew to her hut and emerged holding aloft a boti, a fearsome 2-foot knife set into a wooden board which she normally used to chop straw for her cow. Ek hate goti, ahek hate boti. In one hand she held a bowl, in the other hand a blade, remembered Krishna Chaitanya Mahapatro, a teenager who was jammed into the panicked crowd at the back. Does he look like an avenging goddess? Behind her came a train of fisherwomen brandishing their own blood-stained botis. Perhaps stunned at the apparition, the sepoys left them alone. The third procession, from the north, had set its sights on Tamluk's courthouse, which the marchers regarded as a seat of institutionalized oppression. They approached the building by a narrow road, between the steep bank of a pond on one side and a row of shops on the other. The policemen and soldiers raised their lathis and rifles and charged. Seeing the youths ahead hesitate, a woman in the middle of the procession, 73-year-old Matangini Hazra, took charge. An ardent follower of Gandhi, she had once spent 6 months in jail for displaying a black flag of protest to a visiting viceroy. Now Hazra grabbed the largest tricolour Congress flag and climbed onto a nearby porch. "Cowards!" she shouted at her compatriots. "Return home! I will go on alone. I will not look back to see if anyone came." Then she strode forward, along with several women who were blowing conch shells. Their summons reminded the crowd of its mission, and it reformed. Those at Hazra's side would later report that the first gunshot hit her left hand, and that she took the flag in her right and kept on walking. A second shot hit her right hand, and she grasped the flag against her chest with both arms and kept on walking. The third shot passed through her temple. She died along with several others, including three teenage boys. At Sutahata, 20 miles southeast of Tamluk, the protesters arrived at the small police station to find three constables standing in front, their hands folded in supplication. Their superior officer had left for Tamluk to seek reinforcements but had failed to return, so the three had decided to surrender, while three other constables had gone off to hide. The leaders of the march took them into custody along with their guns, while the people set fire to the straw-thatched station, its records, and the bundles of cash they found inside. As we were leaving, two fireballs suddenly appeared in the sky, Kumudini Dakwa remembered. The authorities, unable to send reinforcements by road, had dispatched two aircraft to drop incendiary bombs on the crowd. "We were so excited at that moment, we didn't care," she said. The bombs passed over the police station and fell into a flooded field nearby, exploding in a shower of fire and water. Later that day, the elders gave their police captives homespun cottons to wear, handed them a little money for passage, and put them on a ferry toward Calcutta. At Mohisadal, 10 miles southeast of Tamluk, Sushil Dara led his 50 youths, uniformed but unarmed, toward the police station. A crowd of people followed the cadets, as did volunteers marked with red crosses on their white garments, who were to aid any people who might be wounded by gunfire and convey them on makeshift stretchers to a schoolroom where two doctors waited with supplies. Dara had heard that the small police force in Mohisadal expected to be overwhelmed and planned to surrender, but when he was still a mile away, he learned that a smaller procession from the east side had already neared the station and was being shot at. 16-year-old Chito Samonto of Kalikakundu was in the front lines of the eastern procession. He had signed up with the Congress 6 months earlier and had been asked to round up the people of Kalikakundu and its small neighbouring village, Boksichok, for the march. Chito's mother came from Boksichok, so the youngster was de facto nephew to all of its male residents, whether they were related or not. A villager named Bolanath Meti had offered to come along. "Don't know what emotion came over him," he said. "Nephew, I will go," recalled Samonto. "He was a very poor man, quite illiterate. Some days he got some food, other days nothing. He bought and sold bananas in local markets." Sri Horichando Das from the border of Kalikakundu said, "I too will come. Who cares what will happen?" As if living in such hardship, he didn't place much stock in life. Sometimes he'd lie around drunk on date palm brew, Samonto remembered. Most of the two villagers had marched, including Chito's mother, elder sister, and uncles. His brother was attending the march in Sutahata, southeast of Kalikakundu, while his father had stayed home. People from several other villages had joined them, so that a procession of about 2,000 had passed the elephant stalls of Mohisadal's palace and approached the police station from the southeastern side. They were about 100 yards away when the first bullets hit. "Bolanath Meti fell. He was right in front of me. I saw he was all bloody," said Samonto. "We were terrified, ran off in all directions. I hid inside a bamboo thicket by the lane." Sheikh Surabuddin, Sheikh Kumaruddin, and Sudam Chandra Das of Kalikakundu got bullets in the knees and thighs. Seeing that his flock had fled, one of the leaders, Manoranjan Bhumik, somehow obtained tin roofing sheets from the bazaar and called to the youths to try again. Chitto and others emerged from the bushes and, holding the sheets ahead like shields, tried to move forward. He was scared, Samonto confessed, but he felt obliged to obey his leader. I was a cadet by that time, not like the other villagers. Bumik exhorted his forces, shouting, "Look, the police station is taken. See, they set fire to a building there." Smoke was indeed curling into the western sky over Mahisadal town. A few of the cadre tried to press forward, but the bullets pierced the tin. "Only one person was shooting at us," Samonto said. "You could see him. He was running this way and that." It was the commander of the Mahisadal Raja's private force. As a staunch supporter of the British Raj, the Zamindar had bolstered the police with his personal guard of Gurkha soldiers, led by a retired military man known as G. Sahib. After they heard of the shooting, Dara and his boys sprinted a mile until they were close to the police station approaching from the south. Immediately, they came under fire from the Mahisadal Palace guards, and a few of the youths fell. Someone brought doors and tin roofs. Hiding behind these, the unarmed attackers tried to crawl forward. But the guards continued to fire, and G. Sahib himself shot at Dara several times. Through all this, the volunteers, marked with their red crosses, gathered the wounded and bore them away, although they, too, came under fire. Dara knew that police records had been secreted at the home of the same police officer whose life, just 3 weeks earlier, he had used his influence to save. Now he did not feel generous. He ordered that the house be burned, and an enormous flame rose into the sky. The bizarre battle at the police station lasted until sundown, when the rebels retreated, having failed to occupy the building. The crowd had managed to unfurl the tricolour at other government offices in Mahisadal, but 12 had died, and at least 2 people were unaccounted for, left behind where they had fallen in front of the police station. One of the wounded, Subhas Samanta, fought all night to regain consciousness. A bullet had entered his chest and emerged through his arm without killing him, but he had lost much blood. Hearing his groans, a police sepoy lifted him off the pile of bodies outside the station, splashed water on his face, laid him on a cot, and fed him some bread. In the morning, the sepoy's shift ended. A police officer arrived to find Samantha on the cot and kicked him off onto the dirt, where he lay all day without food or water. That night, the sepoy again tended his patient. 3 days and nights thus passed, after which Samantha and another wounded man were removed to the hospital in Tamluk. The other man died, but Subhas Samanta would recover and spend 2 years in jail. Astonishingly, the sepoy, Sinhara Singh, was transferred to work as a guard at the same prison, where he continued to protect the man whose life he had saved. After the debacle, stretcher-bearers had borne a grievously injured boy, Bonkim Meti, to the makeshift clinic in a schoolhouse. A bullet had entered through his belt into his lower stomach and lodged against his spine. It would take a major operation to save him, but the police could be coming at any moment. Volunteers carried the rebel to a village where the clinic doctor operated to remove the bullet. For a week the schoolboy bled heavily through the anus, but then, almost by a miracle, he started to recover. He was spirited from hut to hut for months to evade the police, who never caught up with him or his rescuers. As a result of his injuries, he would suffer from cramps and complications for more than a decade. Chitto's uncles brought the banana seller's body back to Boxy Chalk. He had a wife and 2 small sons. They had a terrible time afterward, remembered Samonto. Later, after independence, they got some pension. Sri Horichando Das, how he died, I don't know. We never found him. He went missing. We heard some bodies were lying around, and the police dumped them into the Rup Narayan. Sheikh Surabuddin, made lame by his injuries, could no longer earn a living and begged for his food until, after independence, Samonto was able to get him a freedom fighter's pension. Sheikh Qamaruddin never received that pension, and he would beg for the rest of his life. Nandigram, in the southwest corner of Tamluk subdivision, had been in turmoil since the middle of September 1942, because police teams searching for Congress volunteers had killed 6 villagers. To give tempers a chance to cool, the region's leaders had put off the march until September 30. On that day, a procession tried to approach the town's police station, and 5 fell to bullets. The events of the 2 days were disastrous, not just for the rebels themselves, but also for the credibility of their creed of non-violence. Just several dozen soldiers and guards with guns had easily upheld the British Raj against perhaps 100,000 marchers, 15% of the Tamluk subdivision's population. At least 36 villagers had died and hundreds had been injured. Non-violence could perhaps take credit for keeping the death toll down. No doubt the defenders would have fired more rounds or aimed more carefully if the people had targeted them rather than the institutions they guarded. Surely it was also true that if the crowd had harmed the sepoys and officers, most of whom were their own countrymen, the fight for freedom would have degenerated into a civil war, which in turn would have portended a bitter future for India's people. And even as people mourned their dead, counted their blessings, and pondered the next move, their situation was about to get very much worse. The police established camps in rural Midnapore and began to hunt for fugitives and set fire to their homes. Rather than determining the innocence or guilt of certain individuals, the government imposed fines on entire Hindu communities for political subversion. Often, when they were raiding better-off Hindu households, the police encouraged poor Muslims from neighbouring villages to come along with them and loot, with the apparent intent of stirring up communal hostilities. All over the country, criminals were being released from prison to make room for Quit India activists. According to Kumundini Dakwa, many violent offenders returned to their former village homes and began to prey on the people and inform for the police. Nature, too, began to prey on Bengal. One morning in October 1942, it started raining fiercely. Sushil Dara, who had been lazing with friends under a flimsy open-air thatch, attempted to seek refuge at a nearby house. The wind lifted him and deposited him in a pond. He tried crawling along the path. Alternately flattened and knocked sideways by the gusts, he had ventured some 90 yards when it was as if someone picked me up and smashed me against a massive tamarind tree that had fallen earlier. Dara clung to the trunk, dazed and shivering, until he gathered enough strength to sprint to safety. He could not return to fetch the others from under the thatch, who included an elderly couple who were not strong enough to brave the cyclone. At midnight the wind abated, and Dara emerged with a lantern to find that his earlier shelter had been pounded into the ground. His companions were safe. They had submerged themselves in a ditch to evade the wind and had waded and swum to a neighbour's house. But the banks of the Rupnarayan River had burst and the ocean had swept in. Salt water covered the entire landscape. The cyclone had destroyed virtually every tree and house on the horizon. The day after the Mohisadal Palace guards shot up his cadre, Dara had organized a retaliatory looting of one of the royal storehouses 5 miles north of Kalikakundu. Chitto Samonto and his brother had each managed to carry off a sack of rice. From part of this stash, their mother had made muri, or puffed rice, for the festival of the goddess Durga. During the storm, they stored the muri in a tin, placed Chitto's 6-day-old nephew inside a trunk, so that if water overwhelmed their 2-story mud house, the boy would float away, and huddled with the baby on the attic floor. Chitto and his brother tied the beams with thick rope and took turns holding the roof down against the wind. "We had a knife to cut a hole in the straw thatch if the house collapsed," Samonto recounted. "Then we would all climb onto the roof and float to safety." The neighbours came over after their hut had collapsed. So much screaming and wailing. It was awful. Someone was saying, my cow was swept away. Someone else was saying, where is my mother-in-law? I couldn't find her. All through the night, they had tried to see how high the flood had reached. You could tell it was seawater. It was glittering in the dark, Samonto said. In the morning, dead cows and uprooted trees floated by, as well as a wooden bridge. Strangers had fought the brothers for it and taken it away. They had all eaten the muri and caught a huge carp right there off the porch. After the ponds overflowed, the fish the villagers reared were enjoying a brief spell of unbounded freedom. A few days later, the water receded, revealing a layer of sand that squashed the rice plants. The new crop, due to be harvested that winter, was gone. People began to loot. Samonto said 40 to 60 of them would go to a landowner's house and demand rice. The Samonto's own plot was small, but the family also cultivated a large field belonging to the Mohisadal Rajas, receiving a share of its yield. Still, the landowner's minions took away all that could be salvaged. We managed to sweep up some scattered grains and keep it for seed, Samonto remembered. The rice from the looted storehouse lasted them another month. No more cereal was going to be available for upward of a year until the next crop could be sown in the monsoon of 1943 and harvested at the end of that December. Everyone in Midnapore dates the famine from the day of the cyclone, October 16, 1942. On the night of the storm, villagers of coastal Midnapore had sheltered the wounded pilot of a small aircraft that had fallen near Sutahata, as well as soldiers whose encampments had been devastated by the cyclone. But the subdivisional officer in Tamluk, the most senior civil servant present, had refused to lift the town's nighttime curfew so that refugees from the flood could seek shelter there, or to release government boats for rescuing people stranded on rooftops and in trees. In the following days, Midnapore's district magistrate asserted that any cyclone relief should be withheld from the disaffected villages until the people hand over the stolen guns and give an undertaking that they will take no further part in any subversive movement. A British police officer protested that prompt government aid might win back an estranged populace. But the first relief workers to arrive, from a Calcutta-based private charity, were arrested, and no other succour came for weeks, on orders, it seemed, from Sir John Herbert, the governor of Bengal. In Calcutta, an army general summoned Ian Stevens, editor of the city's leading newspaper, The Statesman, and asked him not to report on the devastation in case the Japanese should guess that the coast was undefended. The cyclone was scarcely a secret to the Japanese, who were repeatedly broadcasting that it had killed more than 100,000 in its first hour alone. And the Bengal government reported to New Delhi that the calamity had left the rebel spirit unbroken, implying that the task remained to be finished. 2 weeks after the storm, a group of ministers from Calcutta arrived in Mohisadal to survey the damage and, from the palace rooftop, saw plumes of smoke rising in the distance. The police had been hunting for fugitives in Kalikakundu. Having failed to find them, the keepers of the law had set their homes on fire. At the time of the storm, Nirmala Kwila of Kalikakundu and her family were better off than most and had grain stored in 2 golas, she recalled. The rice had escaped the flood, but on October 30, 1942, a police team led by a feared superintendent named Nolini Raha had arrived in search of Kwila's nephew. They had not found him and had instead arrested her husband and brother-in-law. Wartime shortages of fuel allowed few villagers to light lanterns at night, but the police had kerosene, which they sprayed onto the thatch and fired with flaming torches. They burned down all 14 huts of the extended Kwila family, the entire hamlet of Kwilapara, along with all the rice. At the time, Kwila had an infant less than 6 months old, With the man gone to prison, her sisters-in-law saved her and the baby by finding enough food to allow her to produce milk. They had continued to live in the charred remains of their hamlet, which was open to the sun and rain. "Where else will we stay?" she asked. "When there were storms, I would clasp my baby in my arms and cry." Not until the politicians who toured Midnapore had returned to Calcutta and threatened to publicize the extent of cyclone damage did the government relent. 18 days after the event, on November 3, 1942, the statesman briefly noted that a storm and tidal wave had killed an estimated 11,000 in Bengal. The unofficial count was 30,000. Most of the dead were from a coastal area of Midnapore known as Konte, southwest of Tamluk subdivision, which had borne the brunt of a 20-foot storm surge. "Hundreds of us insurgents could easily hide in the ravaged countryside," Dara would write, "but when I contemplated the suffering that the people faced, I felt utterly overwhelmed." Satish Samanta organized villagers to repair the banks of the Rup Narayan, somehow procuring muri and chire, flattened rice, to feed everyone while they worked. "We built 8 miles of embankments out of mud," recalled Radhakrishna Bari. After a month or so, the government set up relief centres in the towns, but some who collected rice there complained that the police followed them home to smash pots and trample on the cooked food. A government relief worker charged that by day he was expected to provide succour, and by night he had to indicate to the police and the military the villages that had received food, so that the communities could then be punished. In response to these actions, on December 17, 1942, the rebels set up their own government for the region. Drawing inspiration from a happier past, they called it the Tamralipto Jatiyo Sarkar, or the Tamluk National Government. In the future, it would merge with the Free Government of India, a newsletter announced, but for the time being, the president was Satish Samanta. The teenage Bari began to compose the government's newsletter, called Biplabi, Revolutionary, using news that couriers brought from diverse corners of the district. His elders provided the editorials. Late at night, on the attic floor of a mud house, Bari would print the sheets on an old hand-operated Ronio duplicator. Most copies were distributed in the villages, but local businessmen smuggled some to Calcutta in consignments of betel leaf. The renegade government also set up civil courts that operated with the consent of all parties. More menacingly, it boasted a national militia, headed by Sushil Dara, who would also come to run secret tribunals that tried, convicted, and sentenced informers and other allies of the British, usually in absentia. Ajoy Mukhopadhyay, the finance minister of the rebel government, instructed Dara to serve notices on selected landowners demanding cash in amounts commensurate with the extent to which they were deemed to collaborate with the authorities. Most paid right away, and Mukhopadhyay ordered the arrest of those who did not. Among the leaders of the Tamluk government, he was probably the least committed to Gandhian values. Dara also forced landowners to share any excess rice with the villagers. The Tamluk government's officials got no pay, but they did get food. "We went on strict rations, only a little rice and lentils, and as much vegetable as we liked," related Bari. "Our leaders gave away most of the rice we could get. They also thought of other kinds of food, encouraged people to grow pumpkins. The silt that the flood had brought was very fertile. I never saw such a crop of pumpkins in my life. Only the runners who brought the mail were allowed all the rice they could eat, for they had to go far. It was very hard work." Sushil Dara could eat staggering quantities of food. On one occasion, he downed 150 pithe, or filled crepes. Having to trek tens of miles each day, he found the ration very painful and debilitating, and would sometimes be discovered by his soldiers leaning on his stick in the middle of a path, fast asleep. If there was a benefit to their deprivation, it was that the rebels became as skinny as everyone else, the easier to blend in. You know that Calcutta is being bombed, Clive Branson wrote to his wife in early January 1943, but do you know that an acute food crisis is raging throughout Bengal? Branson was on leave in Bombay, where his hotel served ample food. Breakfast, lunch and dinner are all five-course meals. But reading the newspapers made him melancholy. I fear that we may again be called out to maintain law and order. Don't misunderstand me, not to shoot the speculators, landlords, government officials, but to deal with the angry people who were rioting for food. The price of rice in Bengal had jumped after the cyclone, and in February 1943, official policy gave it a further lethal boost. Leonard G. Pinnell headed the Bengal government's Department of Civil Supplies, which was charged with acquiring rice for Calcutta's priority classes, employees of the government and of firms deemed essential to the war effort. His task, supported by requisition from northern Bengal, had begun well enough. But at Christmas of 1942, Japanese aircraft bombed Calcutta, causing suppliers to down their shutters and labourers to pile their bundles on their heads and stream out. Pinnell had to do something drastic. It had become a fight for survival, for collapse in Calcutta, not only the headquarters of government, but with its port, its railways and its industrial area, would have been a disaster for the province as a whole and for the successful prosecution of the war, he wrote in an unpublished memoir. He forcibly acquired stocks of rice in the city, inadvertently driving all remaining supplies underground. What happened next is best told in the words of another civil servant, Binay Ranjan Sen, who was entrusted with overseeing cyclone relief in Midnapore. A decade later, Sen would head the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Pinnell was supposed to provide Sen's operation with grain, but cyclone relief was getting only a quarter of its requirements, Sen told the Famine Commission. I could not possibly carry on with such meagre supplies. On February 13, 1943, however, he was instructed to no longer rely on Pinnell, but instead to buy what rice he could on the market. The Civil Supplies Department could not fulfil even its primary task of feeding the war effort, Sen explained. When that department's officials found their reserves to be critically short, they instructed their agents to go to any place and purchase at any price and store the rice on behalf of the government. The alternative to such desperate acquisitions was to use the police to seize grain from rural areas, which would probably lead to much violence, Pinnell confirmed in his memoir. Because there were no limits to what the administration would pay, rice prices immediately escalated. Worse, several other bodies, the Bengal Chamber of Commerce, the railways, the Government of India and the Army, were also told to fend for themselves. The Bengal Chamber of Commerce comprised mainly British-owned firms, dealing in ordnance manufacture, jute, coal, banking, tea, tobacco, and other industries, all of which were deemed essential for the war effort. Armed with vast quantities of paper money, these entities began to vie with one another to buy up the winter crop. Sen joined the competition. Every morning, one or two of my men came to me to say that Mr. McInnes, a former bank employee who was working for Civil Supplies, had offered, say, about 22 rupees, and why should I not buy at 21 rupees per maund, Sen related. A maund is equivalent to 37.4 kilograms. Just a few days earlier, a man from central Bengal had offered Sen rice at 13 or 14 rupees a maund. But the same afternoon he found that the price went up to 15 rupees, and he could not keep up the contract, Sen continued. This shows that the prices in the morning were not the same as the prices in the evening. In that way, the prices went up within a few days to nearly double. Civil servant Olaf Martin confirmed in his unpublished memoir that the authorities were asking agents to buy rice and store it for the government in private warehouses, and that every large government purchase helped to raise prices still further. The middlemen were playing the bureaus and firms against one another to extract enormous profits. The absence of boats hampered the trade in grain, but the railway carriages that took troops and their equipment out of the city could bring rice on the return trip. That meant that the sky-high prices in Calcutta vacuumed rice out of rural marketplaces and into storehouses where it awaited transport to the city. In Bengal, half the crop went to rice mills and thereupon to the rural or urban market. The other half, which village women husked by hand, stayed mainly with landowners. By the spring of 1943, almost all the machine-milled rice seems to have ended up with the government and its agents, as well as some part of the hand-milled rice. A district official would subsequently tell the commission investigating the famine that even the larger landowners had very little rice left early that year. Whatever stock was available had been brought up at fantastic prices by military contractors and speculators. Of the 10.5 million Bengali families that depended on agriculture for their livelihood, four-fifths owned too little land to feed themselves in a normal year, earning what more grain they could by working on plots owned by wealthier families. With the landowners carefully husbanding the remnants of their stock, the landless would starve. Later that February, Sen could find only two men, each with a mound of rice, selling their wares in Gaokali, a market town that normally supplied much of Tamluk subdivision, including Kalikakundu. Quite possibly some rice still remained in Midnapore, a cyclone relief worker would later tell the Famine Commission, but if so, the Isfahani Company controlled most of it. In December 1942, this relief worker had seen close to 20,000 tons of rice stacked at a rice mill near the railway station at Kontai. But the mill owners had refused to sell him any because they were under government orders to store it for the agents. Every grain of rice that made it to that mill through normal channels of trade was earmarked for Calcutta, the relief worker would charge. Over the 2 months during which he had seen the grain stacked at the rice mill, the price of rice in Kontai had risen by three times. In a replay of the famine of 1770, rice was being extracted from the countryside to feed the army and the city of Calcutta. If instead the harvest had been distributed evenly, the epidemic of widespread hunger would have been deferred to late 1943, at least in those districts of Bengal that were unaffected by scorched earth or cyclone. But the lifting of price controls and the panicked purchases precipitated famine right away and everywhere. The authorities had been faced with a stark choice, as Pinnell would confess to the Famine Commission. It was either death of a large number of people in the rural area, he said, or chaos in the city, which would have impaired war production and services. The first choice was taken. By the end of February, district officials were reporting widespread starvation in the villages of eastern Bengal and urging immediate relief measures. Biplabi listed seven starvation deaths and a hunger-related suicide that occurred in March in Tamluk subdivision. During a tour that he undertook at the time, Sen concluded that famine was in the offing and its character would be overwhelming. A detailed survey conducted in 1944 by statistician Prasanta C. Mahalanobis and his team would find Bola in eastern Bengal to have been the region worst affected by famine, no doubt because of rice and boat denial, which most severely impacted the east. Among the regions studied, however, Tamluk subdivision ranked second worst, with 13.2% of the population having perished in 1943 alone. Since Kontai had been much harder hit by cyclone, but suffered slightly less from famine, some other factor appears to have increased the mortality in Tamluk. That was probably repression, in particular the destruction of food reserves in the many hamlets that were suspected to shelter rebels. Although by March 1943 famine had set in, the authorities continued to burn down homes and rice supplies, and increasingly they targeted the most vulnerable supporters of the insurgency, women. Kumudini Dakua's husband was in prison, having been arrested for protesting rice denial, but on November 1, 1942, she had trekked with a colleague to the remote village in Sutahata where her in-laws lived. The neighbours warned her not to stay for long, but her mother-in-law was so happy to see her, and it was such a rainy day that she took the risk. At midnight, police and soldiers surrounded the two-story mud house. Soldiers on internal security duty were assisting the police, as authorised by the district magistrate. Sepoys came in, knocked the lamp over, hit my father-in-law, Dakua recalled. They aimed rifles at us, but we refused to leave the house at night. There were many reports of rapes. The police officer restrained his men, told the captives they could leave in the morning, and withdrew. He must have retired somewhere, for after a while two or three sepoys suddenly broke in, ran up the stairs and grabbed the young women. But because police and soldiers were perpetrating many rapes, Dara had supplied his female recruits with daggers. They pulled out the weapons and attacked the assailants, who fled, bleeding but not seriously hurt, down the stairs. Early the next morning, the police handcuffed the women and walked them to Tamluk. Kumudini was 17 but small, and a senior police officer scolded his subordinate for having arrested a child. He said to me, "You stay here tonight, tomorrow you can go home," Dakua recalled, "but I was in prison for 15 months. The first night, in a cell that stank of urine, she stayed awake, listening to an unknown man in another cell singing, "Those whose lives are made of sorrow, what is more sorrow to them?" A week after the flood, the police were searching for Anil Kumar Patro, an 18-year-old member of Sushil Dara's band, and burned down Patrapara, the hamlet of Kalikakundu in which his extended family lived. Their stash of rice was also destroyed. "My father was furious with me," Patro recalled, but Dara visited and somehow managed to pacify the paterfamilias. Soon after, Patro helped the Tamluk militia kidnap a local zamindar and release him for a ransom of 7,000 rupees. The dreaded police officer Nolini Raha hunted furiously for the perpetrators. "He would come with his men and burn down our shelters. He burned some 7 or 8 of them," Patro said. But the chowkidar, watchman, who informed Raha of the rebels' whereabouts, also told the insurgents when to run, so the officer could not catch them. In his frustration, he decided to teach the villagers who sheltered the fugitives a lesson. On January 9, 1943, Dara heard that the police were raiding the village of Masuria, 7 miles north of Kalikakundu, and sent a couple of youths to investigate. Reaching a canal that bordered Masuria, they saw on the other side two sepoys, each dragging a woman by her long hair. The women were Bahula Burman and Satyabala Samanta, according to one of the witnesses, Basudeb Gora. They screamed that several women had been raped, and they feared that they would be too. "We could do nothing. They had guns. We had to run in case they got us," Gora recalled. "The police used to come often," recalled a Masuria villager, Kanonbala Meti. "They would beat the men up, and, not being able to find whomever they were looking for, would eventually go away. Her husband," she attested, "still bore the scars of a whip on his back." That day, when he heard all the commotion and knew the police were coming, he had hidden in a hole that he had dug just for the purpose. Meti, who was 19, had a 1-year-old who was playing in front of the house, and she had run out to bring him in. She could not find him because, it later turned out, her sister-in-law had picked up the child and raced with him to safety. But as Meti hunted frantically for her boy, a sepoy had caught her. She was fortunate that he was the only one to have raped her. The police and soldiers scoured the houses, took all the men they could find at gunpoint to the bank of a nearby canal, and beat them. Meti's father-in-law was also rounded up. "Not a grown man was left around," she said, "and as for the other women, Meti could only hear them. The whole village was screaming. The terror of it." For weeks afterward, she had hidden in the house, too ashamed to emerge in the daylight. "I never lied to anyone. I never quarrelled with anyone," Meti would say, wondering why she had suffered so. According to testimonies subsequently compiled by Bari and others, 46 women were raped that day in Masuria and its two neighbouring villages of Dihi Masuria and Chondipur. Most victims, including a 14-year-old, were each raped by two or three uniformed men and one woman by four. A 21-year-old, Sindubala Meti, had already been gang-raped by the police and was suffering from internal injuries. She died after the second assault. Hundreds of police or soldiers were estimated to have taken part in the affair, some to round up the men and the others to rape. The scale of the attack suggests the complicity of the district magistrate, Niaz Mohammed Khan, if not a more senior official, who had assigned this sizable force for an operation against unarmed villagers. The gang rape in the three villages of Midnapore would have a far-reaching political outcome. It contributed to the downfall of Chief Minister Fazlul Huq, as well as to the induction of a Muslim League ministry in Bengal that would enable Governor Herbert to run the province as he chose. In late January 1943, Shyama Prasad Mukherjee, a politician with a Hindu nationalist party, received from the Tamluk government's courier, Krishna Chaitanya Mahapatro, an issue of Biplabi. Mukherjee had served as Bengal's finance minister, but had resigned his post on November 16, 1942, citing official callousness in the response to the cyclone that he said had possibly no parallel in the annals of civilized administration. According to Mahapatro, when Mukherjee read about the gang rapes, he wept. He subsequently wrote to Chief Minister Fazlul Huq, informing him of the assaults. A few days later, on February 2, Governor Herbert reported to Viceroy Linlithgow that the situation in Midnapore had improved. Even from Tamluk hoped to be able to release troops first week of March if improvement maintained, he declared. In another few weeks, however, Herbert wrote to complain that Mukherjee had made a most venomous statement in the Bengal legislature. Worse, Huq had responded by promising an impartial inquiry by persons of the status of High Court judges into the alleged excesses by officials in Midnapore. It was all very annoying, given that the governor had recently flown to that district to reward policemen who were rendering loyal service in the combat against Congress rebels. Herbert opposed any special investigation into the events in Tamluk and demanded of the chief minister that he explain his failing to consult me before promising it. Fazlul Huq and John Herbert had already clashed over alleged gang rapes and murders by soldiers posted in Noakhali along the coast of eastern Bengal, and the upcoming famine was yet another source of friction. Huq was a peasant leader. He could not fail to observe that rice denial had removed the remnants of 1942's stock from villages, that the cyclone and subsequent pests had damaged the vital year-end crop, that no imports were in sight, that rice exports continued unabated, and that the government's purchases had precipitated an ominous price rise. Huq had repeatedly warned that pervasive hunger was about to worsen into outright famine, which meant that instead of dying quietly in their huts, millions of skeletal, wild-eyed people would drag themselves out of their villages in a conspicuous search for food. But Herbert believed that Huck's alarms had prompted cultivators to hang on to their stocks, an explanation for why the government could not procure enough rice for the war effort. The governor resolved to remove the chief minister. On March 28, 1943, the night before the budget for Bengal was to be discussed, a critical